Chapter 7, The Awakening, A Dubious Blessing. Wildfire has been mixed with it. George Whitefield to his journal. A mighty wave of religious conviction had brought a new nation onto the North American continent, but now a century had passed and on we had replaced holy fervor. People had gleefully begun to explore worldly diversions. Some were starting to question the stern grasp the church kept upon the social structure. Many were simply bored by religion. In that unpromising context, there began in 1734 in Northampton the first phase of a phenomenon that historians call the Great Awakening. It was what the name implies, a faith that had been slumbering, stirred again. The movement was both demonic and exalted, creative and destructive. On the positive side, it led to the founding of many schools, among them Princeton, Brown, and Dartmouth. It added substantially to church membership, but it racked the Presbyterian Church, jumbled the Dutch Reformed Church, started schisms between congregational parishes. It weakened the whole organizing principle of a holy commonwealth under God, which had shaped the first years of colonial America. It is ironic that this emotional explosion began with the low-keyed Edwards. As a preacher, he never used inflammatory tricks, but the cumulative impact of his quiet passion in the pulpit happened to juxtapose with the shaking effect on the community of the sudden deaths of two of its young people in 1734. In that charged atmosphere, Edwards preached a series of powerful expository sermons on the chapter about love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Next, the only general store in town burned down. Its owner, Deacon Ebenezer Hunt, suffered heavy losses, so Naboth collected for him a handsome sum for the times, £50. Two local ne'er-do-wells announced that they were converted. The young people in town, accustomed to meet for parties after church on Sunday evenings, began holding prayer groups instead. By December of 1734, when a young woman who had been a famous flirt said that God had given her a new heart, Edwards reported that religion was the one topic of conversation. Scarcely a single person in the whole town was left unconcerned about the great things of the eternal world. A pleasant milestone was passed that same year. Since Indian raids were unlikely, the town common was not needed as a shelter for cows, so the grazing of cows on the town green was prohibited, and the plot became an attractive park in the center of the village. Realizing the danger of hysteria, Edwards tried to channel his people's ardor into singing meetings, which he hoped might burn off some of the emotionalism. He drew up a guide to test a person's depth of conviction, entitling it Directions for Judging of a Person's Experiences. He counseled constantly with individuals, trying to show them how to use conversion as a first step in a sensible plan for their lives. He stressed that sincere actions were more convincing witness to one's faith than dramatic gestures, but a fury had been unleashed. More than 550 people, half of them men, joined the church. The parsonage buzzed with visitors. People from other towns came to see the excitement. Sightseers came scornfully and seemed not to know what to make of it, said Edwards. When the district court convened in March, many who came to town for those sessions stopped in to see what was going on in the church. The Thursday night meetings drew visitors shores from as far away as Groton, Connecticut, down on the shore. The movement spread to South Hadley, Hatfield, Deerfield, Longmeadow, Northfield in Massachusetts, and down to Suffield, Connecticut, where the local preacher had the memorable name of Ebenezer Devotion. Though she had four little girls to claim her attention and much more company than usual to entertain, Sarah drew upon her deep inner reserves and managed to make this impression upon Hopkins. In the midst of these complicated labors, Edwards found at home one who was in every sense a helpmate for him, one who made their common dwelling the abode of order and neatness, of peace and comfort, of harmony and love to all its inmates, and of kindness and hospitality to the friend, the visitant, and the stranger. For a while, the revival had a bracing effect. Edwards noted that people soon had done with their old quarrels, backbitings, and intermeddling with other men's matters. The tavern was soon left empty. The minister's house was thronged far more than ever the tavern had been wont to be. He lost the tavern keeper's votes right there. Then began an unhealthy aftermath. People could not sleep, for they were brought to the borders of despair, a terrifying sense of God's anger. Edwards battled to keep the movement sensible. A great deal of caution and pains were found necessary to keep the people, many of them, from running wild. Hoping to temper the excesses, he drew up a hard-headed covenant with specific promises about how the people might put their faith into actions. Then he had all the people agree to the covenant in a solemn ceremony. The story of the revival he reported in a faithful narrative of the surprising work of God in Northampton. Originally, this had been a personal letter to Dr. Benjamin Coleman, minister in Cambridge. Coleman thought the account was so interesting that he shared it with Thomas Prince and Prince's associate minister, Dr. Sewell. The Boston clergy sent it along to England with an enthusiastic preface. There it was heartily received. One minister panted, "Never did we hear or read, since the first ages of Christianity, any event of this kind so surprising." The famous English hymn writer Isaac Watts wrote the preface to the English edition of the report, saying, "This thing was not done in a corner. When John Wesley read it on a walk from London to Oxford in 1738, he exclaimed, 'Surely this is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes.'" But by then the barometer had dropped in Northampton. In 1735, a terrifying epidemic of sore throat had raged through the valley. In one town, 99 persons died, 81 of them children. Again, Sarah's good fortune with her children was in contrast to the sorrow in many households. It may in part have been the result of her good sense about hygiene and the sturdiness of her brood. At any rate, her house was one of the few to be spared. Next, the town suffered a sudden, spooky invasion of crows, who filled the air with their strident gossip and woke people early with their conferences on rooftops. This added to the general edginess, and the town put a bounty on crow corpses to discourage these rasping intruders. Edwards conceded. In the latter part of May, it began to be very sensible that the Spirit of God was gradually withdrawing from us, and after this time, Satan seemed to be more let loose and raged in a dreadful manner. One day, Thomas Stebbins committed suicide, and then an eminent man of the community, Joseph Hawley Sr., cut his own throat. The poet Robert Lowell, trying to insert himself into the mind of Edwards, has reflected on this gruesome scenario. At Jehovah's nod, Satan seemed more let loose amongst us. God abandoned us to Satan, and he pressed us hard until we thought we could not rest, till we had done with life. Content was gone. All the good work was quashed. We were undone. The breath of God had carried out a planned and sensible withdrawal from this land. The multitude, once unconcerned with doubt, once neither callous, curious, nor devout, jumped at broad noon. Periods of letdown make a man doubt the reality of God even more than he does in moments of high tragedy. Aftermaths. The morning after a daughter is married, a college campus on the evening of commencement, a convention hall after a candidate has been nominated and the used coffee cups and parade placards remain. These are scenes that test us with jaded spirits. Such was the mood of Northampton as the first phase of the awakening receded. The weather that winter was sensationally cold, the kind of chill that tenses the muscles and stiffens the nostrils. Wood was burned as fast as it could be carried into the kitchen, and Sarah had a baby to keep clean. No one but her husband had a hint that it was happening, but Sarah now entered a period of darkness. Others were not aware that demons clawed her, for she had been trained to be as poised as a princess. A queen does not droop when people are looking. The Sarah who was princess exemplar pushed herself to be perfect, but the glandular part of her got tired and irascible, was fully human. Perhaps she became aware of her inner inconsistency one morning of that interminable February of 1737 after the children had been caged indoors with colds, and she awoke to hear again the nasty tap of sleet on shutters. The human Sarah wanted to burrow back into a pillow. The noble Sarah forced herself to go downstairs and fry bacon for 10 people. Or it could have been a spring day when apple trees were blossoming and the air whispered of wanderlust and young love, while she, combing her dark hair, noticed a gray streak. Or she may have wondered suddenly, when Edwards was away on a trip, why a man was free to ride off while a woman stayed with a nursing baby. It speaks of the singularity of her relationship with Edwards, that she let him see what no other onlooker suspected, her human shortcomings. He later wrote about her that she had been subject to unsteadiness and many ups and downs, often subject to melancholy. The rest of the world saw only the Sarah which Hopkins described. When she herself labored under bodily disorders and pains, which was not infrequently the case, instead of troubling those around her with her complaints and wearing a sour or dejected countenance as if out of humor with everybody and everything around her because she was disregarded and neglected, she was accustomed to bear up under them not only with patience but with cheerfulness and good humor. Edwards wrote in retrospect that in this period his wife had a disposition to censure and condemn others, but Hopkins was under the impression that she made it her rule to speak well of all, so far as she could, with truth and justice to herself and others. Thus she was tender of everyone's character, even of those who injured or spoke evil of her. If there really is such a phenomenon as a saintly character, it seems often to be formed after a stage of conflict and anguish. In time, even the candid Edwards was to report that after this period of torment, his wife emerged with the greatest, fullest, longest continued, and most constant assurance of the favor of God that I ever saw in any person. But such a maturity comes at a price. One hurdle Sarah still had to surmount was her need to feel popular with everyone. This was an inconvenient trait in a woman whose husband had begun to acquire active antagonists. One was Edwards' own cousin, Chester Williams. He lived nearby, and Edwards continued to call on him, though he was snubbed. Williams subscribed to a milder variety of Calvinism called Arminianism, after Jacobus Arminius, who lived in Holland from 1560 to 1609. Arminius modified the strict Calvinist ideas of predestination and original sin, and later Arminian parties went beyond this to the point of arguing that God had given men freedom to choose sin or salvation. Edwards had a complex idea that man's action is caused by everything that has made him what he is. His choices are shaped by all that has happened to him, by his entire life, past and present. Edwards argued that a man's personality is a cumulative unity, and that excellency is his consent to this way in which God has chosen to bring redemption to a grubby world. He mistrusted Arminianism because he thought it could be used to manipulate virtue for man's own comfort. Such a theological dispute seems a silly reason for a family feud, but Chester Williams turned his head away when he had to ride past the Edwards house. This frayed relationship haunted Sarah. Another enemy Edwards acquired by bad luck, not his own fault. He took seriously the responsibility of sharing in the congregational ordering of society. So one of his priorities was the Hampshire Association of Ministers. Thus he was drawn into the matter of ordaining Robert Breck. This curious candidate for the ministry had been a gambler, a hard drinker, and suspected of stealing at Harvard. He tried to be ordained in Connecticut, but President Clapp at Yale had heard about Breck's reputation and blocked him. Breck moved north to Massachusetts and tried again. The association asked Breck to get a letter from Clapp confirming his orthodoxy, so Breck swallowed his pride and wrote to Clapp asking Christian forgiveness. By the time the clergy group in Massachusetts met to decide on the case, it was notorious. A noisy crowd milled around the meeting house to hoot at Clapp when, intransigent, he rode up with his saddlebag full of damaging evidence about Breck. After the meeting was over and Clapp came outside, the crowd acted like boys let out of school. Those in the association against ordaining Robert Breck had won by one vote. Though Edwards had not even been at that meeting, his writing talent was so esteemed that the association persuaded him to prepare the report of the decision. The episode left a smudge on the church politics in the colony, and it left Edwards with a vigorous enemy in Breck. The foundation of the meeting house had become considerably disordered with the passage of years, so the congregation voted to build a new house of worship. There was bickering about the location, for some wanted the building moved to another site, but work had begun in the summer of 1736. A hard rain in September slowed down construction, and the people were still meeting in the old building through the winter. The cruel cold spell had been followed by a crazy early spring with a sudden thaw. One Sunday in March of 1737, an astonishing accident occurred while the people were gathered for worship. As Edwards reported, in the midst of the public exercise, soon after the beginning of the sermon, the whole gallery full of people suddenly and without any warning sunk and fell down with the most amazing noise upon the heads of those that sat under. The falling gallery seemed to be broken all to pieces, so that some who fell with it, as well as those who were under, were buried in the ruins, and were found pressed under heavy loads of timber, but every life was preserved. There is not a bone broken, or so much as put out of joint. March, the most malevolent month in the New England year, was predictably Edwards's unlucky month. It was to be the time when his health and his judgment touched their nadir. This weird accident was a portent. That spring, the town hummed with building noises, for in addition to the construction on the meeting house, carpenters were hard at work on a new courthouse. The church officials were occupied by the touchy matter of who was to sit where. That was still an issue in 1782 in New Haven, when a tutor's wife started an argument by claiming that she outranked a president's daughter. Elihu Parsons, Colonel John Stoddard, Colonel Dwight, and Seth Pomeroy toiled for hours over the seating charts. One person even dared to suggest that husbands be allowed to sit with wives, but this novel proposal was voted down. Finally, the harassed committee worked out a plan whereby Colonel Stoddard and Joseph Hawley, Jr. sat in the most prestigious seats just beyond Sarah. The middle-sized children of the parish, including the Edwards's daughter Sarah, were in the second row, with deacons sprinkled strategically in their midst to discourage any shenanigans. The new building held 738 people and had three entrances with a small porch on the west end. There were six persons to a pew on the ground floor, but in the humble gallery pews, nine people had to squeeze into a row. A move into a new church building is an electric event for the people who have worked hard to achieve it. The Edwards children had checked in with the carpenters each day to enjoy the shouts and hammering and to study the progress of the construction. Their parents had lived through every jot of the calculations of design and finances. Then came the day of fulfillment, when hope was as unscuffed as freshly painted doorsteps. Edwards climbed for the first time into the high pulpit, where his encounter with the transcendent would transform boards and paint, bell rope and Bible, into the house of God. In July, while Joseph Bellamy was a guest in the house, breakfast was unusually disorganized because Sarah was busy having a baby. At last it was a son, Timothy. He became a sober child, unlike his effervescent sisters. Timothy was to be a probate judge, a colonel in the Revolution, a solid citizen, but not a joyous one. One reason why this boy did not turn out to be as blithe as the girls may have been that in the first years of his life, when a child is most affected by his mother, Sarah was emotionally erratic. She went on functioning as if nothing was wrong. To the outside observer, she still appeared almost superhumanly sweet. Hopkins again. She took almost the whole direction of the temporal affairs of the family, without doors and within, managing them with great wisdom and prudence, as well as cheerfulness. Sarah wasn't chewed by the aspirations that make a modern woman restless. A different climate of expectations surrounded a woman then. Not even an educated and privileged one like Sarah imagined any role that might compete with a man. But in this period of physical depletion after childbirth, her disproportionate responsibilities began to overtax her. The sharpest sorrow is the one we dare not confide to any other. A death or obvious disaster is at least evident to others, and friends can comfort us with casseroles and kindly notes. But the shadow we must carry in secret forces us to listen to admonitions about why we should perk up. We must maintain the facade of poise when we really want to screech, "My husband is having an affair. My son has become a surly stranger. I love to distraction. Someone I dare not even name. I'm afraid my daughter is beginning to steal things. Today is my birthday, and where has my life gone?" So for Sarah, the hardest aspect of the emotional season she had entered may have been that she could not articulate it. She could not even allow herself to think. "I'm not as endlessly giving as I appear to be, and this is an impossibly difficult man." So she stuffed the lid back on the box of snakes and continued to pour tea charmingly. But Edwards noticed that there were shadows under her eyes, and that at night, unguarded in sleep, she sighed. He persuaded her to leave the children and take a trip to Boston with him. William Hogg, a Scot, whom they had never met, decided that he wanted to know what his correspondence looked like. When Hogg heard that a young British artist, Joseph Badger, was going to Boston, he commissioned Badger to do portraits of Sarah and Jonathan, and also sent money for the cost of the journey. So Sarah had a fine reason to take a holiday alone with her husband. Travel by horseback is a form of travel like sailing. It links man and nature and allows for leisure to look at beauty. The Edwardses followed a road that had first been tramped by Indians, carrying corn between Boston and the Connecticut Valley. It had been designated a colonial highway in 1673 and led to Boston through gentle terrain, where it was possible to cover as much as 30 miles a day, except on hills and at streams that had to be forded. At noon, they dismounted and stretched while the horses grazed. At night, they stopped with the handiest parson, as many had stopped with them. On the third day, they clattered up a hill overlooking the rich, young, busy city of Boston. In 1740, Boston pulsated. Its symbol was a forest of ship masts in its harbor, for the invention of the Yankee schooner in 1713 by Captain Andrew Robinson had brought faster travel and a boom in commerce. Masts were the product that linked the great American forests with the ocean, tied the New England colonies to the rest of the world. A good mast, 100 feet high, could bring as much as 90 pounds sterling on the market after it had been cut in deep snow, dragged behind oxen from a forest, then floated down a river to a shipyard. It was New America's most characteristic product. About the wharf was a tangle of sloops, schooners, whalers, and fishing catches. 1,000 ships a year put out of Boston, and the city smelled of fish and marlin. Sedan chairs and brightly painted wagons of red, yellow, and blue added to the colorfulness of the street scenes. So did the signs of taverns and shops, some of them painted by such expert artists as the famed Benjamin West. The city was jostling, confident, gaudy, a planet removed from the quiet hayfields of Northampton. For Jonathan, Boston meant a chance to graze in bookstores such as The Heart and Crown on Cornhill. For Sarah, it was a chance to catch up on fashions. She had many daughters to dress, and she had kept her New Haven feeling for elegance. So she peered in shop windows where baby dolls displayed samples of the London styles. Later, keeping that picture in her head, she would add lace to the sleeves of last year's dress to make it look new, would revive another with a new white apron. Many women in that day had aged by the time they were as old as Sarah. They quickly ran out of calcium and thought a tooth for every child was an inexorable rule of nature. Hair fell out and bodies sagged, but Sarah's husband made it clear that he treasured her as more than a housekeeping drudge and the mother of extra farmhands. So she stayed attractive, and 15 years later she was still able to entrance a man much younger than she was. For such a woman, a shopping trip to a city like Boston was as reviving as the return of April. For both Edwardses, the best part of the holiday was a chance to see friends with whom they did not need to explain themselves or deprecate their learning. The trip gave both of them a reprieve from the pressures of Northampton. As for the picture that was painted, Hogg gave the portraits to John Erskine, and after Edwards's death, Jonathan Jr. tried to purchase them. Erskine insisted on making him a gift of them, and the portraits passed down through the family until a descendant of the couple, J. Walter Edwards of Bridgehampton, New York, had to make a decision. As he explained it, "My cousin Eugene Phelps Edwards of Stonington had made a will bequeathing the portraits to me. He wrote to me saying that the portraits should rightfully come to me, but raising the question of whether they should go to Yale, where they would receive expert care. I replied, in what is the only unselfish act of my life, that I thought he should leave them to Yale, which he did." Sarah was to draw heavily upon the inner resources she had been able to accumulate on the trip in the year that followed. On June 20, she had another baby, Susanna, whom everyone was to call Suki, and after her confinement, melancholy was added to her weariness. Her sister Mary was married to William Russell, minister of the church in Middletown, Connecticut, a trading port, and at that time the wealthiest community in the state. Mary was only 38 years old, but she died on June 24, just after Suki had arrived. The death of a brother or sister strikes at the very center of us, for it begins the chipping away of the world we know. So the death of Mary Russell shook Sarah. Then in October of that year, there whirled into Northampton a visitor so unusual that he took everyone's mind off previous agendas. The visitor who left a colorful mark on his era was himself strongly affected by Sarah Edwards. George Whitfield was an English evangelist who was famous on both sides of the ocean. He had made 13 Atlantic crossings at a time when ocean voyages were not pleasure cruises. He may have been a prophet or a buffoon or possibly a blend of both. His voice was fantastic. Benjamin Franklin once stood half a mile away in a crowd he estimated to be 30,000, and he claimed that he heard Whitfield well. The skeptical Franklin, for some reason, took a shine to Whitfield and invited him to lodge above his press shop. He printed his sermons, helped raise funds to build an auditorium for him. Many of the dandified society were charmed by him. The Virginia Gazette of August 24, 1739, said, several fine ladies who used to wear French silks, French hoops of 4 yards wide, tête de mouton heads, wigs, and white satin smock petticoats, etc., are turned Methodists and followers of Mr. Whitfield. They now wear plain stuff gowns, no hoops. Not everyone found him enchanting. Dr. Johnson growled, "His popularity, sir, is chiefly owing to the peculiarity of his manner. He would be followed by crowds were he to wear a nightcap in the pulpit, or were he to preach from a tree." Horace Walpole lampooned Whitfield's charities. "Drop to atone your money at the door, and if I please, I'll give it to the poor." Charles Chauncey wrote to George Wishart of Edinburgh. The grand subject of conversation was Mr. Whitfield, and the whole business of the town to run from place to place to hear him preach. Other clergy feared to lend their pulpits to someone so sensational, so Whitfield preached in the fields to gigantic crowds. The actor David Garrick was fascinated by Whitfield's dramatic talent and said that he could make audiences weep or tremble just by varying his pronunciation of the word Mesopotamia. Garrick slyly added, "His eloquence advanced up to its 40th repetition before it reached its full height." The paradox of Whitfield mirrored the incongruities of the English social scene. Religion bored Horace Walpole, the witty letter writer, who in 1741 took the seat in the House of Commons, which he was to hold with distinction for 36 years. The gamey paintings of Hogarth satirized a pious hypocrisy. Yet, while British opinion makers ridiculed religion, new sects were sprouting all over the islands. That was when the French began to quip that the English were a people of 100 religions and only one sauce. Whitfield was a resounding success in England, and his trip to America in 1740 and 1741 ignited a second phase of the awakening. Whitfield was capable of rather touching self-insight, as in this entry in his journal, "Alas, alas! In how many things have I judged and acted wrong? Being fond of scripture language, I have used a style too apostolical, and at the same time I have been too bitter in my zeal. Wild fire has been mixed with it, and I find that I frequently wrote and spoke in my own spirit, when I thought I was writing and speaking by the assistance of the Spirit of God." He could also show a nice sense of humor, as in his reminiscence about reforming one terrible Scotsman who used to swear to ease his stomach. Yet this same man Whitfield could turn about and make a preposterous announcement such as, "I will assure you, Moses was a Methodist." He once skirted close to slander when he asserted Archbishop Tillotson knew no more about true Christianity than Mohammed. Some clergymen in New Jersey found him unappetizing and tried to discourage him from putting on revival meetings in their churches. Barred from one pulpit, Whitfield had 4 cronies lock the resident preacher in a pew box while Whitfield climbed into his pulpit. Of Whitfield's tour of America in 1740, Thomas Prince remarked that Boston had never seen anything like it before, except at the time of the general earthquake. At the height of his triumph, Whitfield came to Northampton on October 17, 1740. In New England, where winter is stern, October catches the heart. That fall, the hills around Northampton raged with color. The air was sweet with the smell of the apple orchards that were a characteristic of cider-loving colonial America. The agitated scuffling of squirrels in dry leaves said, "Hurry, hurry!" The eye reveled in the gorgeousness, though a passing cloud would bring a premonitory chill. The combination of autumn's poignant beauty and the certainty that the beauty would soon vanish set the mood for Whitfield's visit. He preached four times during the weekend and had one small session in the parsonage. On Saturday morning, he talked privately with the Edwards children, who, he noted approvingly in his journal, were dressed not in silks and satins, but plain. Though Whitfield had openly been of the opinion that most ministers were wolves in sheep's clothing, he liked Edwards. I think I may say I have not seen his fellow in all New England. He was most impressed by Sarah, to a point where he wrote, "A sweeter couple I have not yet seen. She talked feelingly and solidly of the things of God, and seemed to be such a helpmeet for her husband that she caused me to pray God that he would be pleased to send me a daughter of Abraham to be my wife." This was an astonishing observation from Whitfield, a bachelor so prissy that someone had remarked he did not think he should die easy if he thought his gloves were out of place. But after his exposure to Sarah Edwards, Whitfield went out wife hunting for himself. The next year he married a widow, 10 years older than he, but one whom Wesley described as a woman of candor and humanity. The winter of 1740 and 1741 turned out to justify any apprehensions felt in October, for it was the most severe anyone could remember. Men drove horses and carriages on ice-covered Long Island Sound. Down in Philadelphia, the Quaker John Woolman told how the Delaware River was frozen from December 15 through March, and market was conducted halfway between its shores. Many sheep and cattle died. There was another epidemic of the dread disease. Jonathan Dickinson, later to be the first president of the College of New Jersey, wrote up as observations of that terrible disease, vulgarly called throat distemper. In the spring of 1741, there was great uneasiness in town because Edwards asked for a clear salary understanding. This was a radical request. Most ministers supplemented their income with erratic gifts and handouts. Ezra Stiles received in 1 year a cow, a calf, a milking pail, a load of hay, a velvet cloak for his wife, a coat for himself, a cradle for his baby, a cheese, a turkey, a side of beef, a bridle, all as fringe benefits. He also picked up some profits by investing in sea voyages by his parishioners. In 1763, Stiles shipped out 15 gallons of rum and received on the return trip a profitable £769 of Carolina rice. The first salmon caught each year in Newbury, Massachusetts, traditionally went to the minister. Boston's diarist, Judge Samuel Sewell, once wrote that he had called on the preacher and carried him a bushel of turnips, cost me 5 shillings, and a cabbage cost 0.5 crown.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D, MONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.